suppose one thing I should say when I start out this is I feel really uncomfortable. And one of the reasons I feel real uncomfortable is about this is dreams are real important to me. And so I've done a lot of reading and I sort of lecture about it in a very brief way in this class, but I'm hardly an expert on them. So I thought maybe what I'd do tonight is just share what information I have about them and hope that that information might stimulate some kind of questions and discussion amongst us all. As I say, I'm not really prepared to answer many questions. However, I'm always willing to give my opinion on almost anything, which has gotten me into trouble before. So, let's see. Dreams and dreaming. All of us dream, I suppose. Most of us remember them to a degree. Oftentimes, we don't remember them every night. But we have, I don't know how people feel around here, but I guess here in the West, dreams are oftentimes in sort of ill repute, let's say. They're used now by psychologists to sort of try and help you figure out what your neurotic needs are as witnessed by your dreams. They are more of a kind of informational thing, still looked at in a sort of quasi-scientific way. In fact, most of us, if we think about our dreams, probably are uncomfortable with them. I imagine most of us have more bad dreams than good dreams. And we associate that sort of nighttime world, a sort of place where evil comes from, darkness, as part of that. In fact, if we think about what our vocabulary is, what do we think is a dreamer? Somebody sort of wanders around and sort of irresponsible or something like that. And so most of our own language when it comes to dreams is fairly negative. I expect that one of the reasons that's the way it is because of what it represents related to the rational mind. When I talk about dreams sometimes, I relate a couple of stories. One of them is the myth of Proteus. Does anyone know the myth of Proteus? Proteus is a Greek god of the sea. And Proteus had this marvelous ability to grant anybody the wish that they wanted. Whatever wish it was, it could be fulfilled. But the one problem is you had to catch Proteus. Proteus was a kind of guy who not only would have to be gotten out from the depths of the sea through some kind of temptation, but also he had the ability to change shape into anything he wanted to be. So you might grab a hold of him and suddenly he became the most frightening dragon you'd ever seen, or a slimy snake, or some slug, or maybe even a cup full of water in itself. So you'd have to hang on real tight. As long as you hung on real tight, as long as you stayed there, he was convinced that you really were serious about having your wish fulfilled, then he would fulfill it. In some ways, I think that's sort of like that part of us that we call the unconscious. That part that if we hang in long enough, if we take a good enough and deep enough look, if we are serious enough about how our personal relationship to it, then maybe it can grant us a few wishes as well. The other story that seems appropriate now is part of what the myths of Avalon say. For those of you who haven't read it, it's, among other things, it's a book that talks about the conflicts between early Christianity in Britain and what was left of the Druidic goddess religions. And one of the wonderful metaphors in that book is about the magic island of Avalon, the place where the high priestess held her court, I guess you'd say. And as the Christian influence subdued the Druidic religion more and more, the island began to sink further and further into the mists of the netherworld. An island that didn't exist exactly in time, but sort of in a suspended time, where time really was not relevant as it is now. And eventually it just sank into the mists of mythology. In some ways I look at that as a marvelous little metaphor for what the dream world has become to us here in the West, because as the rational mind increasingly subdued other ideas, of other philosophies, the farther and farther we've been able to, we are from that intuitive, that darker side, the part of us that can speak most directly to us through mythology or other things. In fact, the only mythology we have left is sort of hidden in fairy tales, something that you let kids read and then eventually they grow out of. They have toys and they get to play with their toys, and over time we've all experienced that, collecting all the toys and putting them into a box, and some of them you give to Goodwill, and those that you sort of can't quite let go of, you just sort of put in a cardboard box and let them gather dust. And how many of us have had that experience as children of having imaginary or fantasy friends, and can remember the time when somebody would just disbelieve that this person existed or when our parents told us that, oh, come on, you're just imagining, as if the idea of making up images was something bad or useless. So anyway, before I get into some of that, I guess what I might do is just go over some basic ideas of where our Western philosophies about dreams sort of have come from. In some ways, I suppose that dreams were sometimes things that came from the devil. So oftentimes in our not too distant past, we were not interested in sharing or looking at them at all. But mostly starting out with folks just before Freud, we began to look at them as more of a kind of metaphor for something else. So referring to my dreams here. Oh, yeah, one other thing is I guess most of us think about dreams as being benign. The things that happen to us, you can sort of wake up and say, this one made me feel good, this one made me feel bad, this one reminded me of my grandmother, this one means I haven't paid the bills today. Things like that that really don't make much difference to us. But dreams may give us other information, not just information that may be of spiritual nature, but dreams could also give us information about ourselves in ways that aren't exactly psychological, that are more involved with myth, more involved with a deep connection that we all share with each other. Anyway, before Freud, what were dreams like before Freud? Well, I suppose there were three different kinds of dream theory. There was the romantic, the rationalist, and the somaticist. In those little terms, I suppose it says what they are, but the romantic was the idea that a dream contained a hidden but important message from another world, the land of the fairies, and all the rest of that stuff. I think in some ways that may or may not have been relevant to some people, but in the early 19th century, people started looking at dreams as a way of more escaping from their present world into something else, rather than looking at the relationship between the two. The rationalists were people that said it was just a bunch of meaningless jumble, and who cares anyway, wouldn't it be better if we didn't have them? And the somaticists felt that they were a physiological process. If you dreamed, there was something wrong with you. And Freud came along and started uncorking an awful lot of stuff, and one of them was the idea of sexuality and what dreams meant in terms of all that. That dreams had meaning and they had personal significance, and often felt that if he could cure you of your ills, then you would stop dreaming altogether. That was sort of his goal. Interestingly enough. So that dreams, in essence, were a pathological symptom and should be treated as such. Carl Jung, who was the guy who was Freud's student, protege, and eventually left him, felt that dreams were more than that. He felt they came from some inner pool that could be defined in spiritual terms or genetic terms, a pool that meant we were all attached in some way, that thing he called the collective unconscious. Consequently, he would look at dreams as mythology, something that we could all share. Not that it couldn't be personal, but that in that sharing, we could find some greater truth, some greater way of kind of reuniting our lives in a non-rational sense. But even he still focused in on the pathology of dreams. He did a lot of books about symbolic forms, not so much in dream interpretation, because he was aware enough to realize that anyone's dreams are their own, and their symbols are their own. There are no universal symbols. Those books that you've seen in the library that says, this, if you dream about water, it means that you really want to go back and make love to your mother or something like that. That's all really it may or may not have been relevant to the guy who wrote the book, but it certainly isn't relevant to all of us in one way or another. I suppose you could say that it matters in the sense that if we all grow up in the same cultural context, then some of our mythologies will have something to say to each other. A guy named Hillerman, who is a fairly contemporary writer about dreams, now feels that dreams are our own mythology. Since the myths have been taken from us, the idea of gods and goddesses, the idea that animals have a spirit, the idea that they can communicate with us, that we have rocks that talk and an earth that breathes, since that is no longer a part of our contemporary attitudes, then our dreams are the only mythical voice left to us. That may or may not be true. He talks about them in very, very deep psychological terms that, frankly, I'm not sure I can understand very much about. But for me, personally, I find that dreams are an amazing tool. They sometimes predict the future, they more often than not don't. Mostly they confuse me, but I think what they do is they add a kind of richness to my experience of life that is undeniably wonderful. I don't have to understand them to sort of feel like my life wouldn't be the same without them. In fact, as a kid, I was one of the only people I knew who would love to go to sleep. I would beg to go to sleep early because my dreams were wonderful. And I would always look forward to going to sleep and having them. And I later found out that if I had too much chocolate milk, my dreams would be more intense, probably because of the caffeine. So I would always try and drink 2 glasses of chocolate milk if I could. So, anyway, one of the things we think we know about dreams is that dreams only happen when we're sleeping. But that's one of the things that I think is a modern-day myth, that we are dreaming all the time. We are dreaming as we are awake. Some of us are dreaming at this very moment. Dreaming happens oftentimes in that state when we are not yet asleep and not aware. And most of our lives are spent in that state. If we're doing a task, oftentimes it's a task that becomes, we call it meditation oftentimes, where it becomes mindless. And you'll sit there and you'll be knitting, and you'll be sort of listening. And as you're listening, your mind kind of drifts off into this other place. That is a dream. The thing that we don't realize, however, is that we dream in terms of understanding our reality. For instance, we have a kitchen table. We don't usually experience that kitchen table. We already have an idea of what that kitchen table is. We don't watch the light play off of its brown surface. We don't notice every little crumb or grain of salt that may be there. We don't often notice that there's a little chip in the varnish on the left-hand side. What we do is we think of a table in terms of whether or not we had marvelously warm and comfortable meals there when we were a kid, or whether we argued there a lot. And so when we bring to the idea of a table, we're bringing our own personal idea of what that is. And consequently, our realities are often in this other place. There's another thing going on. The problem with having a mind that is based on rational thought is we no longer have access to what else is going on, at least not easily. So the only time we experience it is when we have a flash of insight or intuition, and we say that, well, we don't know where that came from. It sort of came from nowhere, out of the blue. In reality, there has been this incredibly intense dream experience that's been going on probably for days, hours, maybe even months, that have led up to this final flash where that unconscious can push itself through to the place we can understand. So dreams, then, are not just something that we experience at night, are not just something that can be easily interpreted. In fact, the whole idea of interpreting dreams, to me, is problematic at best, because I don't think dreams themselves are something that need to be interpreted in the framework of our waking lives. I think, rather, we should try and unite our dream life and our waking life to sort of find a halfway medium between the two. I was mentioning to the class the other day how many people had been on long camping trips, this kind of wonderful long camping trips where you sleep when you can, and then you're up, and then you're up doing something, and you realize you're probably only sleeping maybe 3-4 hours a night, having a good time, or you're being very quiet, and you're doing a lot of walking. After a day or two of doing that, you sort of enter this strange kind of alternate state of reality. That state of reality where all of a sudden the world seems to make sense to you. Your heart is beating to the rhythm of the stream, and the mountain seems to be talking a language you can understand, and the trees are humming a tune that you know and recognize. That's the kind of thing I think that demonstrates how life can be when you can unite those forces, strong and potent forces. In terms of Black Elk, that's sort of the way that Sioux Indians seem to experience life. So anyway, without getting into any more detail about it in that sense, that is the way I think dreams can be used for us. Also, I think the idea of time is an important part of dreams. In the mythical state of the Isle of Avalon, time was different. Time was not the same. You could go there and you could spend a day at Avalon and you could have been gone years. You could spend a month in Avalon and you could have been gone a day. Time had no context. And sometimes I think that time, as we know it, is an amazing projection of an overactive ego that just doesn't know what else to do with itself. So it creates this strange illusion so that we can at least grow old in it, and that I can understand that. There's more information about all that stuff, but I really don't know what else to say about dreams, at least not on my own. Does anyone have anything they want to share or points they want to add about it?
Lori, why did you say that dreams are important to you?
Well, outside of the fact that I spent most of my childhood dreaming in more ways than one, as an artist, my art indirectly comes from the dream state. Not that I have a dream and I have to then reinterpret it, but that in order to be able to create my work, I have to put myself into a state where my conscious mind is asleep or preoccupied. And it's that other state, that sort of waking dream state that happens, where that sacred place, and meditation is considered sacred for that same reason. People often meditate to put themselves in a place that is what they call, what Jung called active imagination. What happens is that you somehow put a part of your mind that is open to that other place and your awareness together simultaneously, so that your awareness no longer focuses on an object. In fact, that's one of our problems with awareness, is that we constantly move from object to object, person or the chair, something. When you're in that state of meditative awareness, your mind is not focusing on an object. Your mind is watching a whole system, a whole flow. When you get to that place, amazing things happen. Sometimes visualization, sometimes music, sometimes color, sometimes information. And that's sort of what I do with my art in a way, and that's why it's sort of important to me. How many of us have experienced that? How many people meditate here? Have you experienced that same sort of thing? Mm-hmm. What is it like for you?
I don't think I've experienced that in meditation. Meditation is not, gosh, I can't really say what, just I guess I can say, it's like being let out of a bottle if you're smoke. You just slowly rise like that. So I guess it is kind of something you can explain. But at other times, of just quietness, just to see color.
I wonder too about that state that seems to be so healing. You know, I think that all kinds of stuff happen that we're not really quite aware of, and I often wondered what that's about. I've experienced vivid, vivid dreams since I've been here. And dreams that seem to anticipate things that happen the next day that I would not have known about in other ways. And so I'm real aware of the fact that there's a part of me that's very sensitive to what's going on that my conscious mind doesn't know anything about. And the only way that it can sort of talk is through dreams. Wouldn't it be wonderful if it could talk all the time? Well, I think it'd be wonderful. Make people confusing.
That sounds somewhat like a deja vu experience. And I have deja vu experiences all the time. I had a deja vu experience last night at the landing down. Actually, I was washing dishes talking to a woman who lives there. And it was like, man, I know I've dreamt this before. I've dreamt this situation, washing dishes, talking to this woman. And I've had that, I mean, I can remember those type of sensations for a long time now, years. But it's only in the past year or so that I've started to see a pattern and started to realize, and wait, you know, okay, last month I had this kind of experience about this. And how does that relate to the deja vu experiences? Because I know that those experiences were dreamt beforehand. I can't remember exactly when, but I know for sure that they were dreamt. And it's real sure, but then real nebulous at the same time. It's a real odd sensation.
Yeah, it really is. Some people think that happens because that if time is in fact a reality, there's a part of our minds that are aware of the fact that it is, and so it can freely roam anywhere it wants to. And sometimes you get a glimpse of it. I don't know. Sort of reminds me of Slaughterhouse-Five, that guy who was adrift in time.
Do you think there's any way we can you asked the people about any of these experiences. Do you think there's any way we can bring these experiences on, in ourselves, for those of us that don't, that haven't had a lot of these kind of things?
Yeah, I think it's real possible.
How do we do that?
Well, one of them is sort of start a discipline that takes dreams seriously. And one of them is to start a dream journal. And I find that in dream journals, even when you don't dream, when you wake up in the morning, you take your dream journal out, and you sort of write the date and say, I had no dreams that I remember this morning. That just the process of doing that sort of gets your mind more aware of what dreaming is. And then your dreams start happening. They start happening more vividly. They start having more of a relationship to you, to your waking world in some other way. Well, Kate, you've been keeping a dream journal for a long time now, haven't you? Did it help you have dreams when you started doing it?
Well, I really have to laugh because I learned from a man who kept a dream journal. He told me when he woke up in the morning that that's what he did, and I thought that was just highly ridiculous. I mean, that's when you want to get up and have breakfast.
Yeah.
And get off to work. So I observed this for quite some time, and then I was having some real fearful times. I was really scared, and I had a dream, and I was so scared about it, it was like I wouldn't be able to go back to sleep because it was so scary. And in his gentle way, he suggested that I write it down because writing it down helped get it out. So I tried that, and it worked. And there were some really powerfully good ones and bad ones that came out of that. And it goes in stages. Sometimes I have a lot, and then sometimes I drop back. And depends if I've had spices or ice cream or Japanese food. Or it really makes a difference what you eat. Mm. And
try chocolate milk.
Yeah, what stress you're on. And also, just being aware of that possibility. Sometimes I'd be so scared I'd wake up. But I forget unless I wrote it down right away. The other thing that I've noticed is that there are certain symbols or patterns that mean a lot to me. And I don't always dream with the same kind of imagery as other people, but when I was a kid, I had two dreams that seemed reoccurring, and I don't know how reoccurring they were, but they were very important for me. And I just realized when I was up here this past week that there's sort of the same symbol that I've had all my life, that I thought, oh, isn't that ridiculous? People said that before, but it also happened to me.
See, I dream, I can't remember dreams quite often. I dream and I often remember them, but I never experienced any deja vu. Well, maybe once or twice years ago, but nothing recently. And it was that more I was asking about, is to what use. I've never felt that my dreams are benefiting me, other than, and you say you don't believe much in dream interpretation, saying that going to someone and saying, what, you know, can you make anything of this kind of thing, you know?
Well, I really feel strongly that it's what you make of it, because those are your symbols. And someone else might say, oh, have you thought about it this way? Mm-hmm. And it's possible that you haven't, but you know, a year later, when you read in your journal, you go, holy cow, wow! That ties in with another one. So even though they seem all unrelated, when you write them down and read them through time, there are some common things for you. It may be a color, it may be a smell, it may be a feel, or it may be a person.
I think, too, that we all basically have this idea that the only way a dream can make any sense is if it makes sense in a rational way. And I think that the dreams that we have are another side of ourselves giving us information in its own language, its best it can, although it uses material imagery because that's all that it has. And my experience has been the more I pay attention to them without understanding them, the more I start getting a feel for what they're about. And that feeling is what ultimately kind of pricks through into my conscious state. And then I say, oh, hmm. And oftentimes it points out issues that I really just don't really want to think about or don't think are important. And it can be real valuable, but it's not something that happens overnight. It's not something that oftentimes will affect you that way until you've done it for a while. Also, the idea of remembering dreams. I don't know how many people have had the experience of waking up in the morning having a real powerful dream and said, oh boy, that's really something, I'll have to remember this one. And 3 hours later you sort of have a vague recollection that it was there and it's gone. And that's another reason why it's good to write your dreams down right away, because if you do that, there are things you're going to remember that instant that are going to slowly just age. And then the important symbology seems to go. Because a dream speaks in feelings. It doesn't speak in images. We, our conscious mind, more than anything else, sort of imposes them on it. And so catching those feelings down as quickly as possible is what's important. That's why I asked the students to have their journal and a pen right by their bed. If it's not there and it's sort of across the room, they're not going to get up in the middle of the night to do anything about it, or they're going to want to go brush their teeth first, or hit the showers, or do something. And that's all it takes, because as soon as that waking mind of yours is engaged, and you can pack it in, what you remember will be very, very small compared to what it was.
Yeah, I seem to remember my dreams more frequently when I spend lots of time just semi-dozing before I wake up, when I'm with the alarm clock and ready to go. That's when
that's that sacred state that the Buddhists have talked about, and the American Indians have talked about, and the Islam talks about, and early Christianity talked about. It's that same kind of place. And in medieval time, you'd be talking to your soul. And that people would actually have dialogues with their souls then. I think in some ways, their state of consciousness was much more non-rational, which allowed them, I think, to sort of carry on that kind of exchange.
What about dreams being messages or messages from spirits or people who have died or in another dimension?
I can accept that wholeheartedly. I think that to go into dreams to expect that all the time, though, is asking for some pretty sorry disappointments. But I've had enough experiences, and know other people have had, that I can't deny that that happens. And to try and rationalize it, I think that's one of the things people do, is they say, oh, well, let's see. Yeah, that happened, but maybe it's because this and this and this were going on. I really resist trying to impose that a rational system for miraculous information. Because the fact that if you made it rational, not only would it not be miraculous anymore, but you'd be self-defeating the process that we need to reopen up. It's a kind of faith in the information we get, but at the same time, a certain kind of innate skepticism about it as well. Because it's personal information. It's not universal information to me. I may get a great truth that means something to me, but I certainly wouldn't need to think that it meant that to somebody else.
Because lots of times when people describe that they dreamed about someone who had died, then they'll say, I'm not sure if it was a dream or if it was real, as if a dream isn't real, or,
Yeah. There's a woman named Mary Watkins who wrote a book called Waking Dreams, which is a book I brought with me to try and read to prepare myself for this talk, but at some point I said, oh, what the hell, I'm just going to blather. And one of the things that she had this powerful dream that basically started her writing the book. And what the dream was is that at that one point where she was waking up in the morning, she heard this incredible voice that said, let's see if I can remember now what it was, love is imagination and imagination is love. And as she was very aware of what it was, and the voice came from just outside her window. It wasn't in her head, it wasn't in her dream, it was that kind of information. And in her introduction to her book, she relates the story, and she doesn't say what she thought it was. She didn't say whether it was some great spiritual entity, whether it was God talking to her, whether it was her own unconscious. And I think that that's the beauty of that kind of thing, is that you don't have to give it a name. It could have been a spirit of the departed person. It could have been your own intuition. And I like to leave it without knowing, frankly. That's what I think is a problem with dreams, is that the more we try and understand them, the more they, that's why I try and understand them in the morning sometimes makes them go away. I don't ask anyone to analyze them. Is that analyzing is something that I do looking back in my dreams, or unless something about it really knocks me over the head, it's important. The more I think you do that, the more they become something other than they are. In some ways, I think it'd be really a lot of fun if we could all sort of make ourselves stay up to the point where we sort of sleep an hour and then wake up for 3 hours, and sleep an hour and stay up for another 3 hours. Because it doesn't take you long before you get into that state. And then share dreams, be able to sort of talk about what you've experienced. In a group of people who know each other very well, what you experience in the context of those dreams can be very powerful ways of knowing who you are and knowing what's going on around you and opening yourself up to feelings from others.
Well, that's one of the powers of kind of cult indoctrination, and that kind of deprivation. Getting to that state that can zap me vulnerability.
Yeah, that's right. It can be used against you. That's the one of the reason it can be used against us is because we're so unfamiliar with how to use it for us then.
Yeah. Well, I think that was maybe one of the early fears about LSD was that the experience that one would have with that drug that would be a similar kind of dreamed awareness state, and then the vulnerability with that state.
Didn't the Army do a lot of research about that?
Yeah, oh yeah. That guy in France, who, they put him in a castle, locked him up and gave him a mega dose of LSD. He's never been the same, and he's trying to sue, and they're not acknowledging they gave him it.
Yeah. Another example of how if you don't sort of accept that part of yourself, it's used as a power against you. I have this feeling that if people paid attention to their dreams, there wouldn't be any threat from nuclear weapons. Now, that sounds like a really ridiculous statement on the surface, but if you look at it a little farther, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think we create our fears because of our lack of integration. We integrate, like death. One of the biggest fears of our culture is death. So what do? We create the biggest death-making machine there is. So you fear the darkness, you create the darkness. But if you look at it and accept it as something that is there and to be reckoned with, it's a different kind of thing. Anyway, so sort of going off on a track here, I have the problem when you see people let me talk for too long. Did anyone have anything we're going to talk about dreams, that's great. I mean, did you have any ideas what it is you wanted to hear? Just curious.
I was wondering, did someone ask you to talk about dreams, or did someone ask you to talk and you picked to talk about dreams?
Someone asked me to talk about dreams, but I have no idea. Maybe that wasn't a dream. I guess that, in fact, it might have been Chris, who was not here at the moment. She had heard that we were going to be dealing with dreams in the class and thought that, gee, that would be something neat people would like to know about it.
Well, there's always the biblical story that I would, when you talk about the dreams, that reminds me of always as Joseph, having dreams and then being able to interpret the dreams of Pharaoh, and having real specific kind of visions, but then having the dreamer being the successful entrepreneur at the same time, in a sense, counters what you said at the beginning about the dreamer. We think of the dreamer as the space cadet, but at the same time, Joseph in the mundane world was the space cadet, but then ultimately turned things around.
Well, the Old Testament is a pretty interesting thing when you compare it to what culture has become. I think it's a real passionate thing filled with all kinds of visions and miraculous occurrences, but we can accept that as maybe a document of God, but we can't anticipate that in our lives, which is a very different sort of thing. In fact, if we look at the Old Testament as a book of visions, we start getting uncomfortable. So it's just sort of interesting how something that is one of the important fundamental things that our religious philosophy is based on is something that we really can't accept. I think it's a pretty interesting thought. The idea of dreaming and meditation, too, is consistent with just about, I don't know any religious faith that I'm aware of, and I've done a lot of examination in it, that doesn't use meditation and dream as a way of enlivening and enriching it. Who hasn't been affected by visions, who hasn't had that passionate part of it.
Your talk was actually dreams and meditation, he says. I wonder if you could just talk a bit about just what meditation is, because I've talked to a few people out, and it seems to mean vastly different things to different people, so could you just, go on.
I can share what I know about it, and I think a lot of other people here meditate, and they may have other points of view, but just like there are some people who will meditate to music, and other people will think that's a terrible sin, you can't possibly meditate when there's noise around at all. And some people will meditate to have visions, and other people feel that any kind of imaging at all isn't what it is, that you meditate to empty yourself of all, so that the great cosmic nothing is part of what you are about. So there, people meditate in different ways to achieve different goals. But even in the Zen meditations, which are more about emptying rather than experiencing, there's a kind of way that they fill themselves up with the experience of emptiness that is almost like a vision. People I know who have spent time in Zen monasteries have talked about their whole lives become living visions because of the sensitivity they have based on the fact that they spend 6 hours a day in that meditative state. And since I think that if you do that, your dream world and your waking world become the same, it's almost like they live in the moment so much that they dream their experiences of this world. It's a kind of strange kind of thing. For me, meditation is very different. When I'm stressed out, meditation just becomes sleep, I guess. But when I'm really doing it well, meditation becomes very visual kind of experience. It often becomes a dream-like state that I'm aware of as it's happening. I can feel a part of me sort of going, that's interesting. Instead of watching it all. And if I'm lucky, I'm not controlling it. That's the part that's the hard part that I'm talking about. But for me, I use a mantra. I learned how to meditate with transcendental meditation. And what they do is they they distract your conscious mind by giving you something that is repetitive, like a chant. And you say it sub-vocally to yourself, repeating it over and over and over again. And you scope, before I start, I go through a kind of deep breathing place where I just try and empty myself of anything that's there, tension. And any ideas that pop or thoughts that pop into my head, I don't repress them. I sort of let them be like bubbles and escape. And what often happens is that then something just takes over and I experience something else completely. Oddly enough, I found that I was trained in an environment where your meditations were 20 minutes long. Now when I meditate, I wake up in 20 minutes. I sort of emerge from that state and it's 20 minutes exactly. It's really kind of peculiar, unless I fall asleep, in which case it could be 3 hours, but that's another story. I know when I was a kid, I meditated and didn't know about it. I had trouble falling asleep because I want to spend so much time asleep. So I loved science fiction, so I found that I have to occupy my mind with something, so I invented this, my own spaceship. And I would start out the night by opening up my spaceship doors, and I'd walk in the hatchway, and I'd go up to the compartment, and I'd describe the control panel. And usually I'd be asleep before I was done, but if I wasn't, then I'd explore the rest of the ship. And oftentimes I still use that, and I find that I spend very little time in the control room now. I'm off exploring the garden that I have in the back, or my entertainment center. It's just sort of a different kind of way of meditating. It puts you into a different place, and oftentimes what I experience in my first aspect of sleep in that context is very different and pretty exciting. That's when I get very vivid kinds of dreams and recollections.
I mean, sorry, was this?
No.
The problem, well, I don't think it's a problem, but this idea of stilling the mind, emptying your mind of other, how do you do that? Well, you know, I mean, for me, in thoughts, I always seem to be full of big, you know, minds buzzing around everywhere. When you're by yourself, just how would you do it? How would you do it?
I would do it by just doing it often enough so that I get used to it. The first time I was meditating, I my mind was just going around in a million different places. I'd think about everything and anything. And even when I would spend hours doing it, it just wouldn't stop. But over time, it seems to slow down if you're patient. Well, Kate, you meditate. How does it work for you?
Well, I've tried different kinds of meditation, but one of the kinds that worked very well and powerfully for me was when I was in the Dharma Center in Seattle, and they have you say, clear mind. So you just keep trying to let go of all your tapes that you have. Mm-hmm. And it does take some discipline. It's like learning anything. You get on a bicycle and fall off and get on it again and keep falling down and just keep trying it. Everyone else is struggling with the same thing, so what the heck?
They're visuals.
So that, and also, I used a tape
creative visualization tape that helps a lot. So there's a woman who has a very peaceful voice on it, and I identify very well with her. And the timing on the tape is very nice, because I know, oh, I've got 30 minutes, I might as well calm myself down. So I go and try that. Some days it works better than others.
Didn't you have that falling leaf thing?
Yeah. I also have gone to some other meditation classes just to make fun of it, just to try out different ways of calming myself down. And one of the images I use is when they're counting backwards, the image of a leaf falling, just gradually going deeper and deeper. And different people have different imagery that they find is helpful, and that's what works for me.
Imagery is real important for me to do that. In fact, I came back from Greece this last summer with this image that has worked every time whenever I have trouble sort of getting into that lower state. And I just imagine myself from a great height diving down to that clear GNC. And as I sort of get into the water, I just imagine just sort of going deeper and deeper and deeper. Somehow I'm able to breathe as I keep going. And the water itself gets a deeper and deeper blue, and it sort of gets cooler, and I sort of get a different kind of sense, and I'm in that meditated state long before I have to worry about touching bottom. So that's part of it, I suppose, and that helps. But it's not easy, I think, for most of us, because we have just such busy minds. Also, I find it easier in groups. When I first started out, just sort of knowing that there are other people sharing the experience with me made it happen a lot better and faster than doing it all by myself. Somehow I think we don't trust ourselves when we're alone as much as we do when we're in other people, with collective groups, and we, oh yeah, then I know that somebody else here meditates, so I must be able to meditate too.
Why has the power of George Fox?
Yeah. That's right.
That's right.
I think the reason that I meditate is to try and slow my mind down. And I usually will meditate just show that 10 or 15 minutes when I get up in the morning. When I wake up, my body wakes up really slow. I mean, most people already know that I'm not really awake until about 9 or 9:30. I wander around bumping into things. But my mind is really awake, right? If the moment I'm conscious of being physically awake, I know that my mind is right away, it starts going. And what I've developed is just a short time in the morning where I guess I concentrate on breathing and that pattern, because it's at a real slow point that, you know, when you first wake up and you haven't been running around, and so your metabolism, my breathing or whatever, is real slow. So I kind of key in on that, and that slows my mind down, kind of get a little bit centered, and just try and get quiet before the day starts, because then the day always seems to, as it wears on, race and race. Mm-hmm. And that's a good way to keep slowing myself down on a semi-continuous basis.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I'll maybe sit there and, oh, this isn't going to work, I'll just not have breakfast. or sometimes, you know, it'll go longer. It varies, but that's what I've developed. I mean, as far as the focus, I mean, my meditation just actually has a point to it, and then I'm trying to achieve just a quieting of my mind.
I think that one of the things about it is there is an element of surrender to meditation that is kind of alien to a lot of us. That we have to surrender our control, our thoughts. We have to surrender to that depth in ourselves, that perhaps inner divinity, that all that stuff. And that's the toughest nut to crack, I think. As we grow up learning how to control ourselves and others and the world and imposing our will. And now what we're doing is we're opening ourselves up to something else. I think that's a hard one. I brought with me several meditation tapes, and I certainly would be willing to share them if anyone was interested. They're just music, very kind of strange and spacey music that I think is wonderful. It helps me when I'm having a hard time quieting my head to just get carried away by the sounds. It's almost like a mantra in itself. Oftentimes they start out with a melody that you can get your conscious mind hooked to, and then slowly it kind of evolves into just a series of very repetitive sounds that are are beautiful and inducive of a kind of natural, I think, image for me anyway. That's certainly something I'd be willing to do anytime.
Do you ever find that that music, the meditation music you're talking about, that as you listen to it more and more, like you start playing and then it'll bring back, say, a thought or an incident in the past, if, you know, or an experience in the past?
I haven't had that experience, but I can see where it might.
Because some of the mellower music that I use in a, maybe sometimes in a similar way, I've also used in other situations other than just, you know, a meditational experience, just for like quiet background music or something. And I find that I have to kind of keep moving on to other kinds of other artists or other music, because, you know, it becomes so filled with experiences in the past that as soon as I play it, all of a sudden, you know, all these different locations come into my mind.
Yeah.
And rather than quieting myself or emptying my mind or something, it brings everything together and brings a whole bunch of thoughts, which isn't always bad, but it just depends what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. I think that's quite possible.
Yeah, I can't use music because I'm always analyzing the chord structure.
It drives me nuts. It drives me nuts.
That's why I can't look at a mandala. Some people look at a visual mandala to meditate, and I can't, because I do the same thing in a visual term. It's really kind of I guess I'm not going to take up classical guitar. It's going to be the death of my meditation.
Yeah. Well, I think there is something to a meditative state to be in a good performer. I think a good performer is in a zen state of balance, like probably very few people are ever reach it. You're a super athlete.
It's like a super athlete. That's what I feel when I'm giving a concert.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting balance as one, you know, tries to work with that always. At times, my wife and I are both performing musicians, and when she is in a high state of stress or anxiety or training, stress isn't a bad word for it, because it is really as a matter of zeroing in and focusing on a performance that you oftentimes, with the dreams that become closer and related to that experience, we've both found that we start dreaming the concert before it happens. Mm-hmm.
This doesn't have maybe much to do with dreams, but when I was in my first year producing a musical and teaching junior high, everything, I took a Tai Chi class, and the movements are very slow and controlled, and they require a lot of concentration out of your mind and into what's going on in the body. And I really freaked out because it slowed me down, and it was really amazing. I wanted to be at a high pace to be able to do my job and then go to rehearsal and then come back home and have dinner and then go to the next thing and prepare for the next day and survive with all these things that I had brought into my life, all this hyperness. And I dropped the Tai Chi class because it was getting close to the performance. And a couple of years later, I realized that that was the only time during that year that I really calmed down. And that was really amazing, because when I got calmed down, I realized how tired I was.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's why frequently when people start meditating, they fall asleep right away, for sometimes the first months, because they're just so filled with that stress and that anxiety and that exhaustion, physical as well as mental exhaustion.
I was really scared about that. That really hit me hard.
You're sort of living out one of those dreams where you've got a million things to do and you can't quite get yourself.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah, it's your dream world. It's the other side of you saying, hey, slow down, buddy. I have more notes about dreams. I suppose I could sort of rattle some of that stuff off, but I don't know how relevant all that is. More about the waking dream stuff.
Do you have violent or very terrifying dreams?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it was the violent dreams that I was most afraid of, because I had no way of integrating that with my worldview and myself. And those are the ones that I would repress the most. I would not want to remember. We all have certain fears, and the more afraid of it we are, the more it's going to affect us in our dream world. And so I had this one recurring dream where I was constantly loading a rifle, filling it up. I don't own a rifle. I don't know anything about rifles, so I have no idea how. But somehow there was this place where you plugged in this thing, and it would shoot, and I would run around shooting people. And it was a real strange kind of dream. I sort of realized where that came from, ultimately, but it really was a terrifying thing. In fact, it was a long time ago. I don't know how many people remember it. I think it was in the early 60s, some guy in, I think it was Austin, Texas.
Texas, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was a week before that happened that I had that dream for the first time. So I was really freaked out. But I'm sure that guy didn't have dreams like that. Or if he did, he didn't know about it. So.
Is there something you want to tell us about?
How did you get to the point where you could stop repressing your violent or terrifying dreams and start dealing with them instead? Like, so learn ultimately where that one dream came from, and without running away from it again.
I guess I did it simply by deciding that, trying to remember now when it was that this happened. I'm sort of losing track of time. But I think what it was is that I determined that that the dream wasn't a narrative. That, okay, so here I am with a rifle and I'm shooting people, but it's my own symbology. It doesn't mean I'm going to pick up a rifle and shoot people. What it means, I'm telling myself something through my own symbol. And what I realized then is that if I don't interpret dreams in a literal way, then I can look at them and understand them. And frankly, that's sort of exactly what happened. And now, most of the time, I don't look at dreams literally. I look at them in a very symbolic way. And half the time, I don't understand them, and half the time, I do. And sometimes when I share those dreams with people who are close to me, they know exactly what my dreams are about. And so that kind of helps. But so it wasn't really that I was going to pick up a gun and shoot people, but what it was is that I was desperately angry with a couple things, including myself. And what I was doing was I was taking out my own inner frustrations and my anger basically came from being terribly hurt, not really kind of responding to it. And so I was sort of symbolically acting out in my dreams.
So you do think there's a purpose for sharing dreams with people, not just, I don't mean for definite, for someone to tell you this dream means this, this, and this, but you think people can point you in the right direction maybe to, well, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that they could, as long as you just sort of realize that's their opinion.
Yeah, right.
The problem with dream interpretation is that it can get pretty heavy. Sometimes people tell you it means one thing, and it may have absolutely nothing like that at all in mind. So it's whatever feels right. And of course, if you have a recurring dream, then that's something that really needs to be looked at, because it's something that's really bubbling up that's important in some ways.
Do you think good dream interpretation is a dream interpretation where somebody tells you what you're dreaming? I mean, isn't a Jungian philosophy where you come up with your own interpretation of the dream by talking it over with someone?
Yeah, I think at its best, yeah. I don't think that one person can tell another person what their interpretation. But if you live with someone for a long time, they may have some insight into you that you're not real conscious of. I think the thing about it is that we all forget that we really are in complete control over ourselves. I mean, we can decide to accept some information or not. So then we also get to that point of being, if you don't realize that, you can be overly sensitive about what you experience or what. We were talking in class, in fact, about music and how that affects us unconsciously. It can affect your dream world as well, about how it can manipulate you. And how, well, maybe that means that I shouldn't expose myself to any music that might make me do something I don't want to do. Well, that's really not the point. If you know that it manipulates you, then you can sort of realize what it's about. And you defeat it by your awareness of it. And I think that's part of what makes dreams so wonderful, is you, in incorporate it in your lives by becoming aware of it. And part of the awareness is being open to the fact that it makes a sense that your conscious mind may not ever understand. It's real hard to put it into words, because you have to be, for me, I have to be very comfortable with not knowing. I have to be comfortable with not having an answer. I have to be comfortable with the feeling of what it's like, and not always being able to put it in a context I might want to put it in. When I do that, my dreams speak to me in ways that filter through, ultimately, and certainly into my artwork. In fact, the work that I do oftentimes is in that state where I don't know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. I don't exercise very much conscious control until after a certain point, and even then, I no longer have any idea what it means. And then it's done, and I haven't looked at it for a while. I go back and I look at it, and I start realizing that my unconscious is telling me some pretty interesting stuff if I give it a chance. But if I think about it while I'm doing it, it's useless. I interfere with the process. I'm rambling again.
Do you think that all dreams have some relevance, or do you think you can have a dream and it's just is more or less no importance? It's just a dream about, it's just something that happened in the day that's going through your mind, or what?
It's sort of funny you ask that. I've had dreams where I've told myself jokes, and I wake up in the morning kind of laughing. Oftentimes they're not funny after I write them down. I have no idea what the point of them was. And I guess in a way you could say that those dreams don't mean anything, but I mean, maybe they do, and I just don't understand it. I think that when you dream something, you dream it, there's something going on that's happening. And maybe, like you say, it could have been that you ate the Indian food you had the night before. It just sort of did something weird to the blood running through your brain. I don't know. So I dismiss dreams sometimes, just because why bother? If you don't understand it, then who cares?
Yeah, I was thinking about the thing where something might happen during the day, and then you just dream about that thing at night. I mean,
that certainly is possible. But I like to think that life is a metaphor, and it just filled with smaller and smaller, excuse me guys, smaller and smaller metaphors, so that whenever I see something, I always look at it in a humorous context, that this is a small piece of a larger picture, and if I know how to look at the small piece right, it's going to tell me exactly what I need to know in another way. I use never know if I'm repeating myself, but I use the idea of genetic engineering, in the sense that every cell of your body has all the genetic information you need to recreate another whole figure if you know how to do it. So that every little piece of your life is a metaphor. Some things communicate directly to us and we understand them, and some things don't. Whatever moves you is most important. I remember thinking about an iridologist. The first time I heard about iridology, I thought, boy, is that bizarre. That's got to be the weirdest thing I ever heard in the world. Those occult folks, what weird people. And a good friend of mine, I found out, was an iridologist. So, okay, I like this person, so at least I'll take it that much further. And then I started realizing that, yeah, acupuncture works and foot massage works, and iridology is part of it. And there's all these other kinds of things that are just dealing with the idea that in your body is all these metaphorical things you can use to find out about other parts of your body, to find out about your soul, to find out about the world. And so dreams are just another part of it. For me. It's like the world is an amazingly rich place, and it's all saying the same thing if you can understand the language. And dreams are one of the most powerful languages for me. But it talks in a code, and it speaks in a logic that is not a logic. So it's sort of like somebody telling me that I needed to. What was the thing I was saying? It's like, oh yeah, trying to use. For me, sometimes, trying to use your rational mind to understand God is like trying to understand art by dissecting an artist's brain. I mean, they're two completely different forms of understanding the same thing. If an artist does things because of the way their brain functions, taking it apart cell by cell is not going to let you know about that. So I don't think God is a rational thing either. So dreams are the same thing in that sense.
Have you ever experienced being able to control your dreams?
No, I haven't. I've experienced witnessing my dreams. I've sort of said, oh, I see, I am dreaming and this is my dream. But I've never been able to control them.
Experienced waking up and trying to change the direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been able to do that, Kate, ever?
Oh, yeah.
Some people can change the direction, but I certainly haven't.
Can you do that, Paul?
Well, I'll stop the dream. If I have a dream I don't like.
While you're asleep?
Oh, no. I
just by waking up.
I'll wake up
and stop it. Wake up saves you sometimes.
Yeah. No.
I haven't been able to do it. But my father will rerun one dream 3 or 4 times to see how many ways he can make it come out.
That's wonderful.
And he does that without waking up.
That's amazing. How does he react? Does he have any relationship to his dreams that's sort of significant? And how does he? What does he think about his dreams? Are they just movies?
I don't know that he tries to analyze them, but I think for him they're just any other source of information and fun at the same time. Same as emotions or anything in the waking world. I don't know that he considers them a lot or not. I haven't talked with him that much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think my younger brother also does it. Because they were talking about it and I was just sitting in the room and they were comparing notes.
Amazing. Well, I don't think I'd ever wake up if I could do that.
I don't know if this is related or in what it might be, nothing at all, but one thing I've had a lot of experience of is sleepwalking. And I don't know what you think about that. You know?
Probably dangerous. I don't know anything about sleepwalking.
You know. I mean, I just wondered if that was anything to do with dreams and dreaming.
I'm sure it has something to do with it, but I don't know what.
Simon has had some real adventures.
Yeah. Like what?
Oh, well, I don't know.
I think you're going to tell us the lot.
No.
Well, there's a major story.
There's a couple.
I'd really like to hear about it.
Do you think the amount of daydreaming you do affects your night dreams?
You mean daydreaming or fantasizing?
Well, explain the difference.
Well, fantasizing is sort of saying, gee, wouldn't it be nice if this happened? Or daydreaming is sort of suddenly losing your state of awareness and moving off into sort of some other dream while your eyes may be open and while something else is going on. One is like a real controlled thing, and the other one is kind of something else that takes over. So which one did you mean?
Talk about both.
Fantasizing to me doesn't seem to make any difference for me personally. I find that if I'm in that place where I'm doing a lot of sort of daydreaming, that usually comes about the same time I'm doing a lot of other kinds of active dreaming. They seem to come hand in hand. If I'm not doing a lot of dreaming, I'm often not doing any daydreaming either, but I don't think that's an absolute law for me. I have not read any research about how other people are affected. Does anyone else have that same, of course, other experiences?
I don't think fantasizing has any relation to my daydreaming. I don't know about the daydreaming. I mean, my dreams never had anything to do with what I fantasize.
I'd say it would be the other way around. The dream might be something I would fantasize or daydream about for the day after I dreamed.
I see, so that the dream itself stimulates that. I don't know what life would be like without dreams, though. I can't imagine it. Anyone to share their dreams? What did you dream last night? One thing that was really sort of interesting, before Betty came and talked to our class, and she had read that poem that I guess she's read to the community before about masks. And the night before that, I had a dream that was about masks. It was really kind of funny, and it's one of those dreams where suddenly what the dream was talking about is exactly what was happening in the day, and I had absolutely no idea what the day was going to be. And maybe that's coincidence, and maybe it's not. I frankly don't believe in coincidence, so I just think there's some relationship to it. And since I've been here, I've had several dreams that have had direct correlation to what's been happening, sometimes before and sometimes after in a different sort of way. I don't experience that as much at home as I experience it here. I don't know exactly why, except that around here there isn't a lot else going on. I mean, you do what you do, and maybe that sort of allows other things to kind of creep out. And how about now that you've been in the community, are your dreams different here than they were before you came here?
First 2 weeks when I arrived here, I had pretty bad dreams. I don't know why. I tried to figure out why, and I think it's like many small things together, like homesickness, elevation. I was feeling a bit uncomfortable with new people. Feeling closed in from the outside world. Mm-hmm. So like something, what's going to happen now if I suddenly have to go to the hospital? Like, then I said, well, take it easy, there's a helicopter or whatever. And then also, why should happen now in your last 28 years? You didn't have anything that you had to go with. You've never been to the hospital after the war. Probably. Why now? And I think all these things that made me a lot of bad dreams. And when it's really getting bad, and I wake up, I have like a heart pulse, mm-hmm. about 150 a minute. And you know, I know it's psychological, so I go out to the corridor and walk around. It's happened maybe once a month. So. Especially the first couple of days when I came here, it was really bad.
Uh-huh. Ori, have you ever found any association with some of your current emotional states and your dreams? Like say, if you're feeling grief, you know, if someone significant has died in the recent past, does that affect your dreams? I mean,
oh yeah. I don't think I've noticed it so much like with death so much as I have with relationship troubles. And my relationship is going through some hard times. My dreams talk about it all the time and they don't give me any rest. It's like one after another after another. I remember when I got divorced, it was like a person who wanted to sleep all the time, I wouldn't want to sleep. Because every time I'd sort of be reliving all these sort of painful things over and over again. I think basically what my dreams were telling me is that I really needed to experience that stuff and I wasn't allowing myself to do it in my waking world. But that was really a horrible time because I was all weirded out and I wouldn't allow myself to sleep, and every time I'd sleep I had these horrible dreams and I'd relive the stuff I didn't want to relive other places, and I was really a wreck. But in that sense, that really is true. And I've had conversations with people and I'll dream something about the nature of that conversation that night that I hadn't experienced or was aware that I had experienced at that time. And oftentimes that gives me a great deal of insight into the person, into myself, my reaction to it, what my motives might have been or something like that. A direct relationship. I'm curious about the rest of you though. Did your dream life differ when you got here?
I can't even remember having a dream in the last year, and since I've gotten here, I don't remember what they are each night, but I know I've dreamt. When I wake up first thing in the morning, it's like what you said earlier, wow, it was a great dream, you know, and it was really, you really had an impact, but I don't remember it now or later. And I don't know why they suddenly started.
Anyone else? I'm just curious to know if this is actually a trend that we could correlate or whether it's...
I'll bring the trend. I don't think I've remembered a dream like that since I've been here, and I usually do remember a lot of dreams. And I don't know if that's because I'm usually really tired by the time I go to sleep at night, or if I just am... This is a much less hectic pace for me than I'm usually in, and so... Yeah, I'm just thinking about things and experiencing what I'm doing at the time here more than I usually am doing two or three things at once and trying to think of two or three things at once. But here I'm usually just doing what I'm doing and thinking about what I'm thinking about. And then I've been wondering that myself, why I haven't remembered any dreams. I can't remember any dreams I've had since I've been here. Not since May. We also had fire alarms that go off in the middle of the night. I don't know what that does to our dreams. I think we all might have more dreams because it's nice, like you said, when you said that about staying up for a long time and then sleeping for an hour. Sometimes we've had nights where I always wonder what happens after we have a fire alarm at 3 o'clock in the morning. Does everyone go home and have be able to remember their dream after that?
Maybe we could have that a village project. Unless that if there's some
Someone was going
I'll say since I've been here, the first time I've ever really cared about my dreams. I don't know whether I dream more now or not, but I don't ever remember wondering about them, and I think about them a lot since I've been here.
Have you noticed any change in your waking life as a result of that? That's probably not an easy question to answer.
No, that isn't. I don't know if I can answer that. I haven't started writing them down or doing any yet, but I'm working.
Moving
on. I bought a journal.
I have been journaling ever since I started my trip out here. And part of my journal is to record my dreams. And one of the reasons that I've been doing that is because I was very much affected by Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled. And of course, one of the theories that he has in that is that everything is from the grace of God, including your dreams. And there's nothing that's meaningless. And I have had several, you know, what I consider fairly significant dreams since I've gotten here. And I don't know if it's I feel that way because I am journaling no matter what. And I also have had an experience that I've never had before. One night I found myself up and like halfway across the room before I woke up, and with this feeling there was something I had to do. And I don't know how I got out of bed or got there or anything, but I've never, you know, walked in my sleep or anything. I don't know what it was I was supposed to do, but I was up going about doing it.
I hope you got it done.
Well, I don't think I did. I will not. Maybe I will get it done. I have to find out what it is first. Of course, that's symbolic too of me.
I don't know if this is any significant. I had a dream, I remember, some years back now. And I woke up with after this really vivid dream. And I, at the time, I just thought it's so important that I remember this that I've been dreaming about. Whatever it was, I don't know what it was, but it was just something I've been dreaming about. I was just aware of how important it was. And I had this wall. I used to like sleep in the attic of the house where I used to live. And with my there was some wallpaper that you could mark with your fingernail. And I scribbled on the wall this thing, which was just so important, because I thought, I've not got to forget this. And anyway, when I woke up in the morning, I couldn't for the life in me make out what it was that I put there the night before. But I wish I could, because I've studied it that many times, and it was like a jumble of letters or numbers, and I'm not just sure whether some of them were letters or numbers or not. Very strange, I don't know. I don't think that's of any relevance, but I thought I'd say it anyway.
Well, maybe you were just writing in a language that your waking life just doesn't understand. You're going to have
possibly,
to read it when you're dreaming.
Possibly. I was awake, but I remember writing. I physically remember writing, you know, waking up and writing it, and knowing that I was going to fall asleep and likely forget about it, which I did. You know? I don't know.
Now, you're talking about deja vu, and just as he was saying that, I had the feeling that the same thing has happened to me. A strong feeling that I've done the same thing. I also, like a couple years ago, I read a lot about mantras, and I can't remember the book, but I read about a mystic who went through life and just kept repeating this mantra wherever he went, and that was almost the only thing he did, and the effect that it had on him, and I can't remember what the book was. But after that, I got into a sort of a practice of repeating the mantra before I went to sleep, and then I got out of the habit. And every once in a while now, I'll wake up in the middle of the night feeling that there's something really important that I've forgotten, and I can't remember quite what the ritual was, but as if there was some important ritual that I've left out, you know, bothered me for a while, and then I'll go back to sleep and forget all about it.
That's sort of a horrible thought that they're really, that may be true, that there's this thing that you really have to be doing, and you've been getting up and wandering around your room trying to figure out what it is. Well, let's not focus on that one too long. But yeah, that's a strange feeling. I've done that too, where I've written down dreams that are real important, and I can't read my handwriting, because I can't read my handwriting. That's the only problem with trying to write your dreams down right after you wake up. Or if you wake up in the middle of the night like that, scratching it all out.